About writing children's books and the story of her own third chapter. All this on today's Experience Talks. First up, Alva Sachs. Alva Sachs is an author of children's books who started out as a school teacher. She talks now with Tim Carpenter about her midlife transition from teaching to writing and her books, Circus Fever and On Your Mark, Get Set, Go.
Alva Sachs, welcome to Experience Talks.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
So, Alva, you started as a school teacher. I wanted to talk about that first. What made you want to start as a school teacher? What turned you on for teaching kids?
Actually, I didn't want to be a teacher. It was an accident when I had applied to college. It was pretty crowded back in the day, and I was going to go into liberal arts. I actually wanted to be an attorney, and they said, well, sometimes you might need to apply to another college that has less population, and then it's pretty much the same liberal arts classes that you would take, and then you could transfer back into LAS. And I transferred down as a sophomore. I'd gone to community college in the Chicago area, which is where I'm from. And the next thing I knew, I had more hours than I needed for my year that I was in, and I had to start taking education classes. And so by the time I did that, I was hypnotized into becoming an educator.
And you started in elementary education, and I would assume kids were an important role in that.
Yeah, I spent 16 years teaching. I have a master's in education, and I mostly taught fourth and fifth, but then I've done kindergarten through fifth, went back to substitute after my own kids got older. Instead of staying home, I found it to be more rewarding to get back in the classroom, and I loved it.
So you made the decision to make a transition somewhat late in life, in your quote-unquote retirement. What made you want to start writing children's books?
Well, I guess because I spent my life with children, and I have three of my own, and I also volunteered in a lot of areas where children were involved. And my mother had passed away. Two of my children had gone off to college, and I had one child left at home. And I was still volunteering in my community and different types of organizations. And I've always loved theater and the arts, and I did a lot of writing and reading with my kids when I taught in my classroom. And it's funny, I went back and pulled out all my things I used to do when I taught. There must have been some type of foreshadowing there because I pulled out things that I had written like 25 years ago. And I thought, okay, I'm going to try to do this maybe. But actually the impetus was sponsoring my illustrator, actually, at the Calabasas Pumpkin Festival where I met her. And I was carrying her books. And I looked at her books and I went, oh, gosh, this is what I think I really want to do once I held her books. And she said that, I can help you, you know, write your stories, you know, or if you have a manuscript, send it. And I waited about 8 weeks because I really didn't believe that was really going to happen. And that's how I started.
People talk about the empty nest syndrome. Did you experience some of that?
My answer to empty nest is bah humbug. I just don't believe that there is such a thing, because if you think of the word empty, it means nothing, like a void. And to nest means to build and support and to nurture. So to me, how do you nurture an empty hole? There's nothing there to nurture. And so, I don't believe in empty nester. And I think the more we look at ourselves as we grow and evolve, regardless of our age, whether you're knitting or whether you're taking classes or whether you're swimming or volunteering, I think your mind, your body, and your spirit and just everything about you continues. And that aging is a process, but it still allows you to evolve, to reinvent yourself, and to also help others. Maybe you don't want to do a career. Maybe you just want to volunteer. And that just fulfills you and rewards you in so many different ways.
You've written two books, Circus Fever and On Your Mark, Get Set, Go. What inspired you to write those books? What was the inspiration behind each?
You know, people ask me about that. I have no idea where Circus Fever came from, although I did do some writing with that when I was teaching. And we had an amazing writing program brought to our district, and I was one of the leaders of that, and also mentoring other teachers on writing. And that's when I wrote Circus Fever, which was a long time ago. And I had saved that manuscript all these years. And that's the one that I revisited, rewrote, revisited, rewrote, and revised over and over again, and had sent that to Patricia and Marcy, who worked with me on the first book as editorial and layout and copy and all that. And Circus Fever was just there, and it actually became more a part of me at that part of my life than it was when I initially wrote it. And I really think it's important to inspire kids to imagine, to create, to fantasize, and to also help them to socialize and communicate. And when you read stories like that, there's no limit. There's no judgment. And On Your Mark, I like to write things that children would be involved in and have fun with. Plus, I said I'd write a book for each of my kids as the main character. So it just turned out that Jessica, my middle daughter, is in Circus Fever, and Justin, my oldest, is in On Your Mark. And the manuscript for Julie, my youngest, is practically done but not ready for production. On Your Mark, I wrote in my head and had it in my head for 2 years. I never wrote down a word. And I was visiting my daughter in Boston. She went to Berklee College of Music, and she had class even though there was a snowstorm. And I said, Julie, I dreamt my story all over again. Leave me paper and pencil on the table. I need to write this down before I forget it. And it literally, I don't know where it came from. I dreamt it.
What are you trying to accomplish with your books? What's your purpose with this?
Well, when I started my company, Three Wishes Publishing Company, which is for my three children, which I don't know where that name came from either. Seems as if I'm possessed, I think. These things just fall from the sky, like Henny Penny. And I just think it's really important for children to learn to love reading for no reason, just for fun, because they're going to have plenty of time in their lives to have to read for information, for directions, for learning, for careers, for jobs, just anything, even directions. And if you can develop children at a young age to just love reading. And when they're really, really young, as you well know, because you have a child, when you start reading to them when they're younger, you're basically developing a socialization that you can't even put that in words. They'll look at something, they'll point at something, they'll do colors, they'll do animals, and then the next thing you know, they'll start telling you the story through the pictures. And then you'll read it to them, and then when your child reads to you, which is one of my most treasured memories, I was sick in bed, and my son had to read these little books in first grade. And I said, you know, Mommy doesn't really feel good tonight. And I said, I really can't read. And he crawled in bed with me. He goes, that's okay, Mommy. I'll read to you.
That's great.
And I remember it like it was yesterday. And I think today more than ever, children need to develop these socialization skills and communications at an age that's appropriate for them. And to know that reading is fun. And it fills you with opportunities and imagination that no one can give to you.
Is being an author what you expected it to be when you made the decision to do this?
Wow, that's a loaded question. I guess more, I consider myself more of a facilitator. I don't know why, because my mission is to work on literacy and get books into the hands of kids in as many places as I can. Financially, if I had the opportunity to just give my books away, I would do that. And I do donate a lot of books when I can and where I go to schools and libraries and things. So I guess I think I'm just trying to, like, be a facilitator more than an author and share words with kids and experiences.
You mentioned Patricia. You work with illustrator Patricia Krebs on your books. What's it like collaborating with an artist?
It's amazing because I consider myself so far beneath her in talent because there's no edge to what she can do. Besides illustrating, she does jewelry. She's also a singer. She's cutting her first children's CD. She's from Buenos Aires, Argentina, so getting to know her and her culture. And she does paintings and canvases and murals and jewelry, and she's incredible. And I think the thing that has been most enlightening is to see how after 3 years, we interact and exchange in things. So sometimes she'll write me back and she'll go, I think you should end the story. Forget these last two words on this page. Or when she does an illustration for me, the first time she drew the main character, Jessica, in Circus Fever, was not at all what my image was of Jessica. And here I had to tell this gal, who was, I could be her mom, talented beyond belief, that really wasn't my vision of Jessica. And she said, it's your story. I don't take it personally. And the next time we met, she had like 50 little Jessicas drawn out for me. And this one particular page where it would just be her head, where I could just show you in the book, when I looked at that one drawing of her head and her hair and her eyes and everything sitting at the table in this one scene, I saw right into the eyes of Jessica, into her soul. And it just, I said, this is it. And so we do a lot of exchange, and I've grown as an author / facilitator with her over the years. She has really made me want to be a better writer. In fact, sometimes when I write, I go, what's Patricia going to do with this? You know? So I've kind of already got images in my mind, and it has been a tremendous building of team efforts together and respect for one another from where each of us come from.
What is your process as a writer? Where do the stories start? How do you work as a writer? How long does it take you to write a book?
Well, as I said, Circus Fever, I had that manuscript in and revisited it and kind of worked on that and crafted it to where I felt like it could be a story. The second book I dreamt, and it just came from nowhere. I don't know where it came from still, even though it's there and it's out there for everyone to read. The third story I'm working on now for Julie, I was at a conference when I was supposed to be listening and paying attention. But you're so stimulated by all the things that's going on in the conference and the workshops, and you're taking notes and so on and so forth. And I literally thought of a title, which I can't tell anybody because I'd have to, you know, lock you up until it comes out. So I literally started taking notes, and all of a sudden I thought of a title, and I thought of what this title would mean. And it's done now. It's pretty close to getting ready for production. I guess I think a lot about kids, what I did with my children when they were growing up. They're very close in age. And what I would like to read about if I were a child, you know, what you can relate to, what you could have fun to, interactions with friends, with family, with situations that you encounter as you get older as a child that they can relate to, and that parents, grandparents, or caregivers or schools can help to kind of build on those types of stories.
You made a transition from one career to another. For people out there who are doing something now and think forward into the future of what their older years would be like, do you have any advice for people on how to do what you did?
I think, first of all, forget about the term older years. It's like, what is 50 the new 20? I don't know. And I think that, you know, there's always these catchphrases like age is just, you know, state of mind or whatever. And now that I am older, I still think of myself as like 25, although the body sometimes doesn't respond that way. But I think that you need to think about what's in your heart, and if you have a passion for something, or even if you don't have a passion for something, try something maybe you never tried before and realize that whatever you're going to do, I mean, I was never one to sit home, have lunch, watch TV, although I like to watch TV and pop popcorn every now and then and watch movies, but I was always a person that was always busy and trying new things and started working when I was 15. And I think that the more you involve yourself with life and realize that you're always going to be a part of that and to challenge yourself, and it doesn't have to be starting a new career. Like some people have told me, oh, this is nice that you have a hobby now that you're older. And that kind of struck a chord with me because this is not a hobby. It's just I love it more every single day. But if you're going to, like I said, if you're going to go swimming or you're going to do a knitting class or you're going to volunteer at a hospital or a daycare center or even if you love animals, veterinarians are always looking for people to come and help or to welcome people. There's so many opportunities out there that you need to think of yourself as getting better, not older.
Alice Sachs, thank you very much for being on Experience Talks.
Thanks for having me.
To find out more about Alva Sachs, go to experiencetalks.org. Next up, Jean Hirschhorn LePere. Jean is the author of Never Pass This Way Again and has worked as a marketing researcher, antiques dealer, decorator, and social worker, as well as working for Reader's Digest magazine. Tim Carpenter talks now to Jean about her book, Little Man in a Big Hurry, the remarkable rags-to-riches story of her father, Joseph H. Hirschhorn, who was the definitive entrepreneur, financier, and art collector.
Jean Hirschhorn LePere, welcome to Experience Talks.
Thank you.
So, Jean, I want to talk about your book, Little Man in a Big Hurry. It's about your father, Joseph Hirschhorn. First, what inspired you to write this book?
Well, I think having the museum in Washington was a large part of the inspiration. I had done a lot of research on the family before I started this book, genealogical research. So I had quite a bit of information. But I felt that it was a terrible thing that the people who were going to the Hirschhorn Museum didn't know anything about the man who had contributed funds and art, huge amounts, and didn't know anything about him. And he, in his own right, was a very fascinating man.
And this is the museum in Washington, D.C. Yes. at the Smithsonian to,
yes,
to set the context.
Yes. It originally was called the Joseph H. Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden, and they cut out some of that. It was a big mouthful, so they made it the Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden. But, yes, that all came about during his lifetime.
Now, your father was an immigrant. He started with nothing, and he became a man of great means. What was he like? What was the man like behind all of that story?
Well, he was such a colorful character. He was such a dynamo. He had so much energy and a lot of smarts. He was quick. That's being in a big hurry is for sure in every respect. And so he could be shrewd. He was very shrewd. He could be selfish. He was very interested in his own ambition and where he wanted to go and what he wanted to do and what was of interest to him. Not a great father, although we loved him. He was, I have a cousin who always said, if he was a better father, he wouldn't have accomplished the things he accomplished. And that's undoubtedly true.
He became an incredibly astute art collector, might be what he's best known for. How did that start for him? Where did the art bug first bite him?
Well, I would like to comment on your saying that this is what he's best known for, not in Canada. In Canada, he is known as the Uranium King. And while a lot of them knew about his art collecting there, that was not what he was predominantly known for. You know, he was a poor little boy in a tenement, a lot of young children and adults living in this very small New York City apartment. And once a year, the insurance man, that his mother and sister are having insurance for her children, he would come every month to get his money, but once a year he'd bring a calendar. And the calendar had all this Barbizon art, these romantic painters, French painters for the most part. And my father said that he fell in love with those. They stimulated his interest in art, and he put them up on the walls because he thought the walls, which were apparently, I don't know exactly what color green, but some kind of color green that he didn't like, they covered up this awful green. So that's where his interest began, according to him.
That's funny. Your book describes your father in extremely honest terms. You mentioned earlier he was not a great father. He was kind of a controversial guy in some ways. And you speak very honestly about all the pros and cons of the man who was your dad.
Yeah.
Was that hard for you to do that?
I had assessed him pretty carefully for many years in my adult life. I saw the way he related to myself, to his other children. I saw the way he related to other people and to his wives, various wives. And I had kind of thought a lot of it through. I sort of knew he was. I just knew who he was.
And you wanted the people who read this book to experience,
yes,
that in all its...
Yes. There were tales I told that mainly were, the intention was to illustrate some of his bad habits or good habits, his personality, how he functioned.
You mentioned that you loved your dad just for good, bad, and different, but I assume you wouldn't have minded to have him be a bit more involved as a father. What was your relationship like with him?
Yeah, that's very hard to describe. You know, when people talk about their fathers, and you know there's been a very close relationship, he just didn't have time for us. We didn't have that kind of closeness. Yes, of course, I think we would have liked that. I speak for all of us, all of his children. I don't know, somewhere very young, I got who he was, and I just said, I've got to be independent of him. I've got to love him and accept the way he is. So there was not a terrible longing, although I think in the book I describe a situation where I had him, I insisted, it was very difficult, to get him to sit down with me so we could talk and I could say to him, I want you to be more loving or more sharing. And, that, you know, that didn't have any good result. It wasn't evil, but it just did not have a good result. It wasn't in him. He didn't have the capacity.
He did some things in business that were fairly controversial.
Got
in some trouble for a little while there. What was the effect of that kind of stuff on the family? Were you guys scared for him?
I think we internalized it to a certain extent. My parents were, if not divorced by that time, they were certainly separated, and his life was off, away from us. It had been for a while, ever since he went to Canada, which was in 1933. And so, yes, we didn't like that. We didn't even know about most of those things. They hit the Canadian papers. They didn't hit the New York papers. This is not today. This was a long time ago.
Where you didn't know everything that happened every 15 seconds.
Nobody was picking over everybody else's navel in those days, no.
This is your second book. I wanted to talk about your first book as well. You wrote a book called Never Pass This Way Again,
right,
about an experience that you had in Turkey. What was the story behind that book?
I went on a six-week cruise. Two weeks were in the islands, and made a couple of stops in Turkey. And I took a land tour for 3 days, overland tour, off the ship, and we were going to rejoin the ship at a different port. And during that time, I was enticed by some very, needy, emotionally and financially needy Turkish young men to buy three small heads. And I really probably did it more out of guilt, because we had so much and they had so little. But at any rate, when I got back to the ship, I was told that those heads were suspicious. I was not hiding them. And that I was going to be arrested. And I was indeed arrested and put in prison. I was in a woman's dormitory-like prison for 23 days. It was a very frightening experience. It was not like Midnight Express. Of course, everybody was scared to death. It was like Midnight Express. My family was staring their hair out. But it wasn't like that. The Turkish women were very nice to me. And it was a very, and I used it as a time to say, well, who else is going to be in a Turkish prison? I better take notes. This is different. So that's what that's about. And eventually, I did get out. And the trials went on for many months afterward. I had a Turkish attorney who to this day I'm still friendly with. That was in 1983 that this happened. And she went to all of the trials, and I was tried in absentia, and I was found not guilty.
Amazing.
It was amazing.
You have worked in several very interesting jobs over your lifespan. Yeah. You've been an antiques dealer and a social worker. You've worked in market research. What made you want to become an author?
I didn't really. I never wanted to be a writer. Never had any ambition. I had a friend who used to say, I'm going to be a writer in college. And I said, no, I'm going to have a cottage, you know, with a bunch of children and all this. And so I had this romantic notion. And she had three children, and she didn't become a writer. And I became a writer mainly because I thought in the first instance that what had happened to me was something that the world should know about, because it was so interesting. How many people are going to be in a ladies' prison? And a Turkish prison at that. And the book of my father, as I think I said before, I was motivated strongly because I thought, this is a terrible shame. There is no biography of this man at the museum. It is there now.
Do you want to write more, or do you have plans to write another book?
You know, I'm not awfully good at imagining things. I couldn't write fiction. I can only write truth, experience. And I'm not sure are there any left that are worth writing about.
You aren't going to go out and get arrested and put in a jail in Kazakhstan or
no
anything like
way.
That.
I'm too old for that. I always think if I had been, I was a very youthful 56 at that time. I mean, I could do anything. But I thought if this happened to me today, I wouldn't have the strength to go through it.
Do you share your father's passion for art? What do you feel when you go to the Hirshhorn Museum and see the works?
If you'd go to my house, you'd see the walls from floor to ceiling practically are full of art. I don't have his same passion because I don't have his pocketbook. I like going to the museum, and I did used to spend as much time as I could with my father when he was in Washington and I was living on the East Coast. That was easier to do. I could go down there frequently. No, I would say that the passion is not quite the same. I'm not as acquisitive as he is or was. He was extremely acquisitive.
Jean, congratulations on a great book. It's a really, really good read, and people should read it.
Thank you very much
for being on Experience Talks.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
To find out more about Jean Hirshhorn LePere, go to experiencetalks.org. And that's our show for today. Tune in next Saturday at 8:30 a.m. for Bobby Zeno's Experience Talks Cultural Nexus. We'll be back on Saturday, May 29th at 8:30 a.m. when we play a show with artists Phoebe Beasley and John Otterbridge that we taped in front of a live audience at the Piedmont Senior Art Apartments in North Hollywood. Experience Talks is produced by the nonprofit Engage, catalyzing the art of active aging. We'd like to thank production guru Stan Mizrahi for all his help with our show. On behalf of the Experience Talks team, remember, age isn't what happens to you, it's what you do with what happens to you.
Good morning, you've been listening to Experience Talks here on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, streaming live worldwide at kpfk.org. Coming up next is The Car Show with Art Gold and guest host Dave Koontz.
Only 2% of the people change the machinery of government. My name is Jamie Cromwell, and Deborah DeLiso and I are part of an interactive theater event, The Einstein Plan, by the world-famous playwright Donald Fried. Our first two performances sold out, so due to popular demand, we're doing it again on Sunday, May 23rd at 7 p.m. Together with you, the audience, we'll answer the 2% question with a progressive call to action for all committed, politically aware Americans. The Einstein Plan is at the Los Angeles Theater Center, 514 South Spring Street in downtown Los Angeles. Tickets online at www.theeinsteinplan.com. For more information, go to kpfk.org.
In preparation for the play, all members of the public are invited to participate in a community advisory board event where you'll meet the cast and director of The Einstein Plan and discuss the most important political issues of the day. That will take place Tuesday evening, May 18th, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Cathedral Center of St. Paul, 840 Echo Park Avenue, Los Angeles, 90026. Directions are available by calling 213-884-5190 or at the KPFK website, kpfk.org.